Redeemer Digital Media Ministry presents the Reverend Dr. Carl Ficken presenting a lecture on Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Session 4 is on Bonhoeffer in a Changing World and Letters and Papers from Prison. It was recorded on February 19, 2012 in Rudisill Hall at the Lutheran Church of the Redeemer in Midtown Atlanta, Georgia.
Let's begin this morning. I'm going to use a prayer from Bonhoeffer in the Letters and Papers from Prison. There's a section of prayers that he wrote. So we'll begin with one of his prayers. Oh, Heavenly Father, I praise and thank you for the peace of the night. I praise and thank you for this new day. I praise and thank you for all your goodness and faithfulness throughout my life. You have granted me many blessings. Now let me also accept what is hard from your hand. You will lay on me no more than I can bear. You make all things work together for good for your children. Lord Jesus Christ, you were poor and in distress, a captive and forsaken as I am. You know all human troubles. You abide with me when all others fail me. You remember and seek me. It is your will that I should know you and turn to you. Lord, I hear your call and follow. Help me. Amen. Well, last week we didn't get to ethics. For those of you who weren't here, we didn't make it to the book of ethics, which I think works out okay because that way we have some time for that this morning and for the letters and papers from prison as well. It's no surprise, really, that Bonhoeffer should, in these difficult years, turn to the study of ethics, making his own contribution to that field. By 1939, he was deeply involved in reading some of the major ethical studies of his time. Betke says that in those years, Bonhoeffer came to see ethics as his life's task. He worked on this task, in some sense, by himself. With Cost of Discipleship, those of you here last week will remember, he worked on those lectures for his classes at the seminary in Finkenwald. He was preparing lectures, presenting those lectures to his students and getting their feedback and then revising and rethinking. His work on ethics, however, was a much more private venture. He studied his sources, reflected, and began writing. And of course, he would never see the finished product. In fact, the various manuscripts he kept revising and rearranging, and even had to hide some of his manuscripts from the Nazis. He did not really finish this text, in other words. It's a better text than the text of Christ the Center, the Christology lectures that were just taken from the notes of his students, because it's all his work. But he acknowledged to Betke that his ideas, quote, were not yet altogether in shape. Betke talks about Bonhoeffer making many different starts on the book, different ways of approaching his subject. But Betke believes that with each new start, Bonhoeffer was deepening his emphasis on two important themes as foundational to a discussion of ethics. One, this wouldn't surprise us, a more resolute Christ-centeredness. And the second may surprise us, a more realistic openness to the world. A more realistic openness to the world. We'll talk more about what that might mean. We have observed his Christ-centeredness in other works, and we will have to talk more about that note about openness to the world, partly because some Christians have a trouble about being open to the world. I mean, the world is often presented to us as an evil. I mean, in John's Gospel, for example, Jesus seems to take the world as a pretty rough place and time. So we have that sort of tension in our background and in our history about... On the one hand, the world is created by God. It is God's gift to us. On the other hand, the world is a dangerous, threatening place. that seeks often seemingly to underride, undercut our attempts to be faithful. It is impossible in the time we have, of course, to do justice to this heavy work. It's a pretty substantial book in itself. And the fact that it's not exactly maybe the way Bonhoeffer would have finally put it together also complicates the picture. But the most important observation to make about it is that this is an entirely Christocentric emphasis on ethics. I don't think there are many pages in the book where, many single pages, where words, Jesus, Christ, God, are not in the text. And I don't think there are a lot of ethics books that would work that way. For Bonhoeffer, that centrality of Jesus is of prime importance. He is grounding all his reflections on the reality of Jesus Christ. Also, this is not an ethic that seeks to address and give solutions to numerous ethical issues. He does talk about some specific issues, very briefly about abortion, fairly extensively about labor, about torture, about truthfulness, and other such topics. But what Bonhoeffer really does in this material is to provide a context for ethical decisions. And that context is grounded in the power of God's action in Christ. Once again, I've selected a few quotations just to give us a taste of what he's doing here. Early on, he discusses a sense of ethics as formation and warns against a tendency in our social order to force some kind of conformation on various issues onto the whole population. So when Bonhoeffer talks about formation, he makes it clear he is not urging a broad conformation to some Christian principles. Rather, he sees formation comes only from being drawn into the form of Jesus Christ. Formation means Jesus taking form in his church, which is, you remember, exactly what he was saying way back in the Communion of Saints, where he talked about the church as Christ existing as community. To be conformed with the incarnate, with the crucified one, is to be a person sentenced by God. The church is the people in whom Jesus has taken form. Those phrases like that run through all of this. The idea is that Christ forms us, shapes us. We do not so much form ourselves by trying to conform ourselves to some moral standard. So, quote number one on the sheet there is about formation. Somebody want to read that? Okay, thank you, Gene.
Formation comes only by being drawn into the form of Jesus Christ. It comes only as formation in his likeness, as conformation with the unique form of him who was made man, was crucified, and rose again.
I don't know whether you have any, but maybe too soon to get reactions to this. One of the things, the difference of what Bonhoeffer is talking about, I think, here, is on the one hand some kind of moral standard. This is the way we should behave. These are the rules we should follow. We should be, you know, maybe based on some Ten Commandments or other rules of the social order. But Bonhoeffer is rather not so much talking about that as he is talking about an identity with Jesus. And that means looking at Jesus' life, including crucifixion and resurrection, and looking at Jesus' teachings. So it's a, do you see how there can be a difference of approach there in terms of ethics, whether you're following a sort of moral standard or a Christ example? Yes, Anne.
Is that like law versus gospel?
Well, yeah, it could be. There's some of that in there, I'm sure. Of course, the law and gospel for us is a kind of tension, that the law is certainly there, condemning us on occasions that we know about, and the gospel is there, encouraging us and supporting us. But I think here it's more that Bonhoeffer sees that there can be certain moral standards out there that derive from all sorts of places, and that may not necessarily be conformed to the whole story of Jesus, the sacrifice of Jesus, the resurrection of Jesus, the suffering of Jesus, the identity of Jesus, the commandment of Jesus to love one another. Yes, Paul.
Aren't we entering into a relationship with Jesus?
Yes, exactly.
And it's not even personal discipleship that gets us there. It's almost like a marriage relationship, and it's, I don't want to say it's all subliminal, but you want to, by having a relationship with Jesus, and because Jesus is the Son of God, then you act like He acted or would expect us to act. But that doesn't necessarily, that's one situation. It's not really conformed to what's expected of you as a citizen,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
or whatever.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Bonhoeffer also notes that, number two, somebody.
The point of departure for Christian ethics is not the reality of one's own self, but a reality of the world, nor is it the reality of standards and values. It is the reality of God as God reveals the divine being in Jesus Christ.
That's sort of the same thing. That's just another way of saying what we were just talking about. When Bonhoeffer talks about love as an ethical category, he makes clear that he is not thinking about a general human love for other people, but about the utterly unique event of the laying down of the life of Jesus Christ for us. Number three.
Love is inseparably bound up with the name of Jesus Christ as a revelation of God.
Yeah. So you see how he keeps building this connection with Jesus as a way of talking about his ethics. When he comes to talk about the structure of a responsible life, he introduces the concept of deputyship. We know deputies as the guys who were second fiddle to the sheriff most of the time, but they were, as he understands the term, it is a way of acting in the place of someone else. I suppose a deputy is acting in the place of the people at large, as a representative of the people, to try to curb some evils or difficulties in the society. So, but what the way Bonhoeffer sees this is in terms of then of caring for other people, interceding for them, suffering for them. And of course, as you might guess by now, he sees Jesus operating in just that way. Number four. Tim?
Jesus, our life, lived in deputyship for us as the incarnate Son of God. And that is why, through him, all human life is in essence a life of deputyship.
Now, does that term make any sense to you? You see what he's trying to get out there? And what it seems to mean is that, this is no surprise, Luther said it too, right? We become little Christ to others. And that's the kind of life that Bonhoeffer is describing here. Toward the end of this volume, Bonhoeffer makes an observation about the role that ethics and ethicists might play. And interestingly enough, he does not really see that as a big role. A book on ethics is not supposed to tell us exactly how we must do everything. And an ethicist is not a person who knows better than anyone else what shape human behavior must take. Bonhoeffer says, ethics and ethicists do not intervene continuously in our lives. And I think we all know that to be true. We may have studied some ethics or read some ethics or thought some ethics, but probably when we're trying to make a decision, we're not running to a textbook somewhere. We're drawing on the resources that we have built up in our lives. So for Bonhoeffer, a Christian ethic is vital and has the object of placing before us the commandment of God, which Bonhoeffer sees as something totally different from what he has been discussing as ethical. The commandment of God, he says, embraces the whole of life. It is not only unconditional, it is total. It does not only bind, it also sets free. And it does this by binding. It sets free by binding. In Bonhoeffer's view, God's commandment is the only warrant for ethical discourse. The commandment of God is the total and complete concrete claim laid to human beings by the merciful and holy God in Jesus Christ. God's commandment, which is manifested in Jesus Christ, comes to us in the church, in the family, in labor, and in government. Now, when he's talking about God's commandment, he doesn't use the plural. It's not necessarily making it totally clear what he means by commandment. I would think that what we have to go on are the Ten Commandments, for one thing, not the host of laws that Israel came up with beyond that, but the Ten Commandments, and Jesus' commandment, Jesus' gift of a new commandment, to love one another. That begins to fill out what God's commandment in the singular might mean, seems to me. Paul, did you have something?
I always just said the great commandment, you know, to love God with all your heart, yeah, and all your soul, and right, mind, and neighbor as yourself.
Yeah.
Would be what I would think.
Yeah, right.
But I guess you're going to get to it, but Bonhoeffer had a lot of trouble with this when he joined the conspiracy to assassinate Hitler.
Oh, yes.
A lot of trouble. I mean, I guess he would consider that maybe to be unethical behavior in one sense, but against the command of God.
Yeah, I think that's why this is so intriguing, that he spends these years, when he's involved in the resistance movement, trying to write a book on ethics. Because it has to be difficult for him. I mean, you ask yourself the question, as someone did to me this week, is whether or not you could do that. Could you be a part of a movement to kill a person, a dictator, an oppressor? And I don't think that's an easy question for any of us to answer. I don't know.
I think it is.
You think it is?
Yes.
you would volunteer?
Well, if somebody, yes. But between that and having them kill 6 million people, I think that answer is very clear.
Yeah. You can certainly, I think you can understand, when you just think about that, you can understand how Bonhoeffer could do it. Though it's a matter of somebody coming to you and saying, we need you on our team, it might be a little different, might be a little tougher. Probably right.
We know it was tough for him.
Yes, it was tough for him, definitely. Yes. Yes.
Well, I was just going to say, it wasn't necessarily just killing one person. You had a whole group of people who,
that's right,
would have to be, you know, basically eliminated, because, you know, you kill one and the other's going to try to step in because, mm-hmm, they all had agendas.
Right.
It's not that simple of problem to try to solve.
And the conspirators had different agendas.
Pardon?
The conspirators had different agendas.
Mm-hmm.
I lived, when I went to school in Germany, on Stauffenbergring and Bonhoefferweg, and they had different agendas, both of those two gentlemen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We also have examples in the Old Testament of men who slaughtered the enemies.
Yes. Yes. And those are sometimes troubling commandments, it seems to me, but they are there, for sure. Yes. As I said, ethics is, it's tough, it's not an easy book to read, but it is. It certainly shows us the issues that Bonhoeffer was dealing with in these years. And remember, ethics is placed between the time he left the seminary and the time he went to prison. So it's reflection that was going on with all the background he had in his reading of theology and of ethics and his experience with the resistance movement.
Is it fair to say that most ethics studies are isolated from the Christian faith? Basically, trying to find some kind of moral basis in general understanding or general consciousness.
Right. I think many of them are. I mean, there are many books on Christian ethics, because many theologians find it necessary to tackle that subject as a sort of almost obligation. If you've thought through the theology, then you may have an obligation to also think through what it might, how that affects human life and the decisions that people have to make. So many good theologians have written books on ethics, but there is also what you might call a secular ethics that is just out there that a lot of people write about. Yes, Paul.
I'm a lawyer. I have a code of ethics, mm-hmm. and all my conduct is governed by a code of ethics. Heaven forbid if I should cross the line. Mm-hmm. I think medical doctors have codes of ethics.
Sure.
And I'm sure pastors do too.
Right.
So you have in that sense, you have ethics and ethical behavior.
Right.
We don't hear much about ethics per se in the church.
Well,
using that terminology.
Maybe that's true. We hear about Christian living, though, which is sort of what it is, isn't it? I mean, I think we do hear about that. We certainly ought to be thinking about it if we're not. But yes.
A lot of times, maybe the word ethics comes up whenever there's a scandal of some sort mm-hmm. within the church. I mean, whether Lutheran church, Catholic church, etc.
Right.
Then someone may raise that issue. Isn't there ethics? How could this happen?
Right.
Whatever incident has occurred.
Right. That's certainly true.
And oftentimes your ethics run into, you can be conflicted, mm-hmm. like a priest-pendant of confidentiality. You may know if something is going to happen, it may be injurious to a lot of people. You could prevent by reviewing these confidences, and you're there, you have that information.
Right.
Sort of like Bonhoeffer situation in a way, mm-hmm. in joining the conspiracy. Lawyers run into that too. I mean, I have to zealously prosecute a case, even if at some point in time I may lose some of my, the client may, or the cause may lose some credibility. I have no choice mm-hmm. professionally, but it may conflict with my religious upbringing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You're probably right that it's a topic we might want to find other ways to explore, because we probably don't talk about the most serious issues of that. Maybe not enough in our community of faith or reflect on it in our personal lives. I don't know. Let's turn to letters and papers from prison. The last book. And in many ways, one of the more interesting books. Bonhoeffer was arrested on April 5th, 1943, and sent to the Tegel prison in Berlin. He would spend 18 months there. At the beginning, he was on the third floor, but when the Allied bombing over Berlin intensified. He was moved, I suppose the others were as well, to the first floor. And all this time he was trying, as best he could, to camouflage his role, to disguise the facts. His brother-in-law, Hans von Dachnanyi, was also in prison at the same time, in the same prison. And there is in the letters and papers from prison one exchange of letters from them. Somehow they managed to write one another. I don't think it happened more than that one time, but it did happen then. On another occasion, during an air raid, when the whole prison was thrown into chaos, they actually managed to spend a little time with one another, talking about strategy. I mean, you've got to get all your lies straight and all your attempts to wiggle straight. So Bonhoeffer and Hans von Dachnanyi did have that opportunity. They're spending some of their time trying to figure out how they can keep things away from the investigators and get through this time together. Of course, Bonhoeffer also had occasional visits from his parents, from his fiancée. He had letters that were smuggled in and out of prison thanks to sympathetic guards. Shortly after that February 1945 air raid, Bonhoeffer was moved from Berlin to various other prison sites, including a time at Buchenwald, and leading, of course, to his execution at Flossenbürg on the first Sunday of April in 1945. And I have told you of his final words there: "This is the end for me, the beginning of life." On one earlier occasion, he is reported to have said to his fellow prisoners who had been involved in the resistance, "Let us go calmly to the gallows as Christians." There's no evidence of how his fellow prisoners took that. Going calmly to the gallows is noble, but I would guess also difficult. Clearly, he saw his activity in the resistance movement as related directly to his faith. It was something that grew out of his sense of who God is and what God wants for this world. The book, Letters and Papers from Prison, this is one version of it. You can see a little worn. It's been through various translations and versions, and it includes not only letters that Bonhoeffer wrote and smuggled out of prison, but also letters from his parents, his brothers, his fiance, and of course Betke and a few others. There are even a few communications in here between Bonhoeffer and his interrogators and the prison officials, where Bonhoeffer seems to be trying to clarify his testimony. It was Betke who gathered these sources together, the letters together, first in 1951 under the title Resistance and Submission. That was the original title of the collection of these letters. In 1953, the letters were published in English under the title Prisoner for God. And then subsequent issues kept getting a little larger, and the titles finally settled on Letters and Papers from Prison. But additional material was added as it was found. Of course, we know that these letters were not intended for publication. They were private letters that Bonhoeffer was writing. I mean, I can't imagine that he would have even thought about the possibility that they could be published at some point. Because in some cases, he's thinking aloud. He's writing to close friends or to family. And he's not advancing a sort of detailed theological argument. He's thinking through his situation and the situation of the Christian faith in these difficult years. And some of the material here has to do with really is not in the form of letters. For example, when Eberhard Bethke, his friend, married Bonhoeffer's niece, Renata Schleicher. So Bonhoeffer wrote a sermon for their wedding. And when they had their first child and named him Dietrich, Bonhoeffer wrote thoughts on the day of baptism and sent that to them for the baptism of their son. There's some poems in here that he's written, some pieces of fiction, and of course letters from other people, including his parents and brothers. Now, what we are to make of this book, we should, I guess, have to look at it at the very end of our session this morning, but you should know that many people have tried to make very different things of it. I think I mentioned in our first session that that Dr. Martin Marty published this biography of the book. It's a biography of this book. You don't often see biographies of books, but this is apparently a series where they're doing some of the great books and sort of analyzing how they have, what their life story has been. Well, Marty points out how various people have used Bonhoeffer's works over the years. Communist in East Germany took some of his ideas from the letters and papers from prison and saw that as reinforcement for their thinking. Bishop Robinson, you remember Bishop Robinson, Honest to God, back in the 70s? And the Death of God theologians here in Atlanta relied heavily on Bonhoeffer's work. They saw things in there that would support their positions. And today, occasionally, some of the so-called evangelical Christians find support from Bonhoeffer. So, it's sort of true that a lot of people want to claim Bonhoeffer and bring a peculiar slant to his work. You will see by the end of the hour that I, too, have a particular slant. The book begins by what Bethke calls a prologue, an essay written by Bonhoeffer late in 1942, just before he was imprisoned. And he gave it as a gift to Bethke, to Hans von Dagnani, and to one other person. It is entitled After 10 Years, 1942 back to 1933, Reflections on what those years have been like since the ascension of Adolf Hitler and what those years have meant to Bonhoeffer and his friends. It's an exploration of what courageous and committed action means in times of uncertainty and in times of horrible evils. Bonhoeffer seems to be providing a rationale for the activities in which he and his friends have become involved and to explain them both morally and from a Christian perspective. He points out that they, that is he and his friends, are not Christ. Both their actions will not save the world. They are, however, Christians who must share in what he calls Christ's large-heartedness, both by their actions and by their sympathy on behalf of all who suffer. The final paragraph of the essay did not appear in the first edition, but Bethke adds it as a kind of unfinished thought. Another paragraph he founds believes it was written about the same time, suspecting that Bonhoeffer really wanted to add it to After 10 Years. And there is this sentence, which is number 5 on your list there, that is at the beginning of that paragraph and gives us Bonhoeffer's perspective. Someone do that.
We have for once learned to see the great events of world history from below, from the perspective of the outcast, the suspects, the maltreated, the powerless, the oppressed, the reliable, ensure from the perspective of those who suffer.
It seems natural in a way that Bonhoeffer would come to this, and that he's thinking this before he is imprisoned. And he really presents this not just from the perspective, say, of a person dissatisfied with present social conditions, but from the perspective of one who seeks justice for all, from God's perspective, in other words. For the first year and few months, the letters focus more on what prison life is like and Bonhoeffer's concern for his family and friends. There are references to his reading, and especially to his reading of the Bible, requests for books, speculation about how his case is going and what might happen. At one point, he speculates that he thinks he might be released soon or perhaps inducted into the German army. He doesn't really begin his deep and sometimes perplexing theological reflections until a letter to Bethke on April 30, 1944. This is a year plus after his imprisonment. Midway through the second paragraph of that letter, Bonhoeffer writes, "You would be surprised and perhaps even worried by my theological thoughts and the conclusions that they lead to." He says he wishes he and Bethke could talk in person so that the ideas his ideas and his thinking might be clarified by the conversation between the two of them. And then he goes on into some of his concerns, and that begins with number 6 there. Somebody would take that, please.
"I should like to speak of God, not on the boundary."
Excuse me. Is that number 6?
Okay. "What is bothering me excessively in this question Christianity really is, or indeed who Christ really is for us today."
Yeah. Does that surprise you?
This is a far cry from the writings in Life in Heaven.
Yeah, the kind of confidence that we've seen.
Even almost naive.
Now he's asking the question of what does this really mean? What's it all about? And so it makes you wonder whether the prison experience is undoing his faith. Huh? At least he has seen suffering on a personal level, not in any abstract. I don't doubt that he understood the depth of suffering that was going on, that was being caused by the German government. But now he himself is experiencing that. He goes on to ponder if perhaps the time of religion is over, wondering if the time of religion is over. He wonders if the time has passed when people could be told anything in words, whether inwardness and conscience have passed, whether we are moving to a religionless time. He wonders how Christ can become the Lord of the religionless. All kinds of things that seem in conflict with one another, right? Christ as the Lord of the religionless. And he wonders what a religionless Christianity might mean. A religionless Christianity. He thinks that perhaps Christ would no longer be an object of religion, but really Lord of the world. Now, I don't know whether that strikes you as it does me. It's a little strange. I mean, he's talking about Christ not being an object of religion, but then he wants to say that Christ is really the Lord of the world. The previous questions make you wonder if he is doubting his faith. the affirmation that Jesus is really Lord of the world corrects that somewhat, you see? He ends that letter by saying that he has to stop writing because the time has run out. He's afraid he's got to get the letter in the mail. His opportunity to put it in the hands of a guard who will take it out for him is going to happen soon, he thinks. But then he starts up again, observing that he finds he does have a little time to write some more. So he picks up on the theme. And that's number 7, if someone would read that. Amy?
Religious people speak of God when human knowledge has come to an end or when human resources fail. In fact, it is always the deus ex machina that they bring on to the scene, either for the apparent solution or insoluble problems, or as strength in human failure, always, that is to say, exploiting human weakness or human boundaries.
Okay, you know about the deus ex machina, in the Greek theater, the humans get into trouble, and the gods are suddenly dumped onto the stage by machinery that lowers them from up above to solve the problems of the humans. What Bonhoeffer is dealing with here is beginning to draw out a picture of how he understands the word religion. That religion is about a human quest for something, for peace, for happiness, for protection. And for us, we don't think about God so much until we get really in a bind, and then we hope God will come to the rescue. And he's thinking that he seems to be suggesting that that's the shape religion takes. It starts with our needs, our hopes, our struggles. And the distinction between that and Christianity is that Christianity starts with God's action. Starts, continues, and ends with God's action. God is at work in the world. God is the initiator. God is the one who brings the gifts of grace and peace and encouragement and strength to us. So he's beginning to draw a distinction between religion and Christianity. So that when he talks about a religionless Christianity, he's talking about a kind of Christianity that isn't focused entirely from our end on what's supposed to happen, but that is focused from God's end. Somebody tackle number 8.
I should like to speak of God not on the boundaries but at the center, not in weakness but in strength. God is beyond in the midst of our life. The church stands not at the boundaries where human powers give out, but in the middle of the village.
Okay. Is it possible that religion can put God at the boundaries? Almost on the edge, not quite really helpful until I am desperate and need God's help.
At the time that he wrote this, Pastor, remember there was a church, a right church.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's speaking somewhat to that. As a matter of fact, even the prisons had the guards and the staff had a life of their own with their families, and they even had a church mm-hmm. in the little compounds that were outside the prison wall.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the context in which a lot of these statements are being made, the Christless church,
right.
The non-Christian religion.
Right. And they had seen that. They had seen that in their struggle in the German church. Bonhoeffer and his friends had understood. They called theirs the confessing church, because they were confessing Christ as Lord, and God as the agent of life and strength. So yes, thank you, Paul. That's it's that context of his immediate situation in Germany, and that's part of what he's dealing with here.
It seems to me also that the conclusion of that quotation is a very good description of what he's trying to say in Living Together. I mean, I think the community he describes there is indeed a church in the middle of the village.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, so I mean, that's part of the interesting thing about working through these letters is that you see both tensions and also continuations in what he's dealing with here.
I think when we look at what he's saying, this is so synonymous with what Jesus experienced in the Garden of Gethsemane, and mm-hmm. also what John experienced in prison. Mm-hmm. He sent word to find out if Jesus was the one.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jesus told the person to tell him the blind see, the lame walk, mm-hmm. and blessed is he who does not take offense.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Then the struggles, you know, I mean, Jesus had struggles with whether he was doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And he said, Lord, not my will, but your will.
Yeah, it's very clear in the New Testament, it seems to me, that the seeing things from below, as Bonhoeffer says, from the position of the suffering, is a Christian position. It's a hard one, and not all Christians buy into that, I think, but there it is. Well, over the next few months, Bonhoeffer would work on these same themes, play them out in his mind with Bethke. In a letter on June the 9th, 1944, he takes another step. That's number 9. Someone read that? Yes.
Mm-hmm. The question is, Christ in the world that has come of age.
A world that has come of age. What does that suggest to you? A world that has come of age. The world has grown up. Remember, he was talking about worldliness. A world that has come of age. This is 1944. What did Bonhoeffer know about a world come of age with the technology? Could he have imagined the technology and all the stuff that we have going on today? That kind of, there is a certain sense in which there's a maturity about that, I guess, an expansion of our capacities, a broadening of our vision. All of those things may go into this, but not sure that's what he's getting at here.
That means, Carl, could that mean that there's a world war possible? You know, that we're in it. But at that time, you're in a... You know, there's a world come of age. Just mean that, you know, I guess really for the second time or so, a world war that involves the whole world.
Yeah. Yes, and reflecting on how that war and its aftermath is going to affect the lives of people. Yeah, that's certainly has to be part of what he's dealing with. He suggests that that the weakness of liberal theology was that it conceded to the world the right to determine Christ's place in the world. I think you can understand that sometimes a general religious perspective puts Jesus in a certain position, and that may or may not be consistent with the biblical witness. It's That's what he's playing with, at least. And he goes on to argue that in number 10, my view is that the full content, including the mythological concepts, must be kept. The New Testament is not a mythological clothing of a universal truth. This mythology, resurrection, etc., is the thing itself. We sometimes tend to think of mythology as something sort of made up, something fabricated. He is wanting to affirm here that the fundamental teachings of the church, such as the resurrection, and all that means in terms of the gift of life and refreshment and renewal and overcoming of suffering and crucifixion, that the resurrection is real. It's not something made up, but it is real. It is the thing itself. And that's part of the reality of the gift of God for us. So, a few weeks later, he picks up this theme again, and that's number 11. Paul, yeah.
The difference between the Christian hope of resurrection and the mythological hope is that the former sends us back to life on earth in a wholly new way, which is even more sharply defined than it is in the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, Israel is delivered out of Egypt so that it may live before God as God's people on earth. Redemption myths, such as suggested in a release from the cares, distresses, fears, and longings, in a better world beyond the grave, arise from human boundary experiences. But Christ takes hold of us at the center of our life. That's kind of a tough one.
Yeah, it is a tough one. You see what he's saying there? That a lot of times what religion wants to do is salve our wounds, comfort us, and assure us of a better life in the future. And Bonhoeffer reminds us that in the Old Testament, the people of Israel are always called to action in the present, in their world. They are to come out from under whatever suffering or persecution they faced, and they are to be God's people. And they are to affirm God, and they are to witness to God, and they are to live like God's people, obey God's commandments in this lifetime. You know that in the Old Testament, the view of afterlife was Sheol, darkness, settling into the grave. So he's saying here that in the Old Testament, the people of God were called to duty in their time. And he's suggesting that what Christianity really means then is the same thing. To be called to duty in our time. Not to think of religious life as future. Yes?
Is this how he's justifying his involvement in the Old Hitler assassination?
Could well be, yes. Yes. Yes.
And how does that fit with his last words?
Good question. The question was, how does that fit with his last words? This is the end for me, the beginning of life. You may have some ideas about that. If somebody want to?
I was just my observations from yesterday, the Whitney Houston thing. I mean, religion is used by a lot of people just in those circumstances as something to turn to, you know, say there's a better life. And what Bonhoeffer was saying, no, it's for now, it's for living, it's for action, and so forth. I think he's got two stories. One he's finished here on earth as the disciple Bonhoeffer. Another one he's going to be with the Savior. I don't know that they're inconsistent.
Yeah. It seems to me when the guards came for him, he knew that it was over. There wasn't a question anymore of whether he could survive and continue his work. So from that perspective, facing death, he can say, this is not the end, this is the beginning for me. But it's because he was in that extremity that he can say that. And that's still a faith position. It is a proclamation of his understanding of God's vitality and God's living presence.
As a matter of fact, his work did continue after he died. and had much more impact than when he was alive. So it was, in a sense, a beginning.
That's true, too. Very good. Very good. Then there's a letter of July 16th. We're getting close to the times. I'm watching that. I think we have about 5 more minutes, maybe. Letter of July 16th, when he picks up again on this theme, and that's number 12.
God would have us to know that we must live as people who manage our lives without God. The God who is with us is the God who protects us. As in Mark, my God, my God, why have you forsaken us? The God who lets us live without the working hypothesis of God is the God before whom we stand continually. Before God and with God, we live without God. God lets himself be pushed out of the world onto the cross.
Okay. Yes, wow. Curious ways we can admit to talk about God. Before God and with God, we live without God. What can that mean? Part of it, I think, means in what he's saying there about God letting himself be pushed out of the world onto the cross. That is, in the God's suffering on the cross. It is God's suffering on the cross. That is the place where humanity is. And that is God's identity with humanity. That is seeing the world from below. And we tend to think about God as all-powerful, on high, totally removed from human experience, seated on a throne or something, and don't always bring together the God on the throne and the God on the cross. And I think that's part of what Bonhoeffer's doing here, is reminding us of who God really is. Paul?
You were going to say what your theme was, and how are you using Bonhoeffer? Is this how? To bring us the theology of the cross?
Yes. I'm getting there. I have one more little step to take. We might run out of time. Yes, we have. He sums up his distinctions in number 13. Let me take that one. Here's the decisive difference between Christianity and all religions. Human religiosity makes humans look in their distress to the power of God in the world. God is the Deus ex machina. The Bible directs us to God's powerlessness and suffering. Only the suffering God can help. This, Bonhoeffer sees, as a starting point for a secular interpretation of Christianity. I mean, he calls it a secular interpretation. And his concluding thought is that we are summoned to share in God's suffering at the hands of a godless world. So Bonhoeffer is making the case for an understanding, for a distinction between Christianity and religion. So what he's been talking about religionlessness, he sees religion as a negative term, really, basically. And he sees that much of what we do in our cultures, what he saw in his culture, I think what we can see in our own culture, is that religion is often involved in little stuff about our deals. What's going to happen to us, how we're going to survive, how we're going to prevail. Christianity is the story of God's creation, suffering, resurrection, God's power in our lives, God leading us not just to get by ourselves, but to be a people who identify with and stand with the suffering in the world. Now, I confess that's not an easy position to be in, because most of us are fairly well off, fairly comfortable, and we can do some things from a distance, sort of like the food ministry. That's a wonderful thing our church does, and it can be a way that some of us can think, yes, we're doing this, we're identifying with the suffering, but that's really not quite enough, is it? And I think that's why I think Bonhoeffer is here in a letter of July the 21st. He clarifies his sense of this worldliness. By this worldliness, I mean living unreservedly, and this is number 15, in life's duties, problems, successes and failures, experiences and perplexities. In so doing, we throw ourselves completely into the arms of God, taking seriously not our own sufferings, but those of God in the world, watching with Christ in Gethsemane. That, I think, is faith. That is metanoia, the Greek word for repentance. And that is how one becomes a human being and a Christian. How can success make us arrogant or failure lead us astray when we share in God's suffering through a life of this kind? Bonhoeffer is putting us on the side of those who suffer and calling us to live out our lives in that context. So my slant on this is that that's what Bonhoeffer's about. This isn't about trying to advocate for the death of God or for some kind of uptick in morality, obedience, to worrying about obedience to all sorts of rules that some believers think are vital. Dare I say contraception is part of that. Contraception has very little to do with God's task in the world, to relate to the suffering, to bring aid to the sufferer, to right the wrongs of injustice in this country and this world. We don't spend nearly enough time worrying about that. And I think that's part of what, for me at least, that's part of what Bonhoeffer means, and part of what he calls us to. And if you see, if you remember the preface that we read, the note we read from the preface at the beginning of this part of the discussion, where Bonhoeffer talks about our sharing Christ's large-heartedness. There's an awful lot of small-heartedness going on in our culture right now. To share God's large-heartedness and acting and feeling with and for all who suffer. That, I believe, is what Bonhoeffer calls us to. That, I believe, is what God calls us to. Thank you all very much. Thanks very much to John.